284 East Euclid, Shafter, California. The interview is a part of the Oral History Program, California Odyssey Project, Cal State Bakersfield. The interview was conducted by Judith Gannon on April the 6th, 7th, 1981. Okay, Mr. Crane, if you would just like to begin with your earliest memories of what life was like in Haskell, Texas.
Well, my mother and father and one brother lived in the little town of Haskell, Texas, and from 1915 to 1930-31. In fact, we came to Shafter Christmas Eve day of 1930, and of course 31 was my first year of experience in California. But prior to leaving Texas, my father owned 14 acres of dry land farming area, worked on the railroad, and of course I was only 20 when I came to Shafter, and had about 3 years experience in a cotton gin. I came to Shafter cotton area and wanted to get into the ginning business, of course, and I didn't succeed in getting into the ginning industry, and for 10 years I worked on farms around Shafter.
Okay, before you go on to talking about your experience here in Shafter, let's go back to Haskell and tell me a little bit about what your farm was like and what it was like for you in Texas.
Well, my mother and brother and myself farmed a small acreage. One year, I remember, we went out and rented. My dad took off the railroad and went out and rented a farm. But that's the only year we went into extensive farming. The rest of the time, my mother and brother and myself kept a small acreage in cotton or hay. And, of course, we raised our own meat. We raised enough hogs to make our meat. We had chickens, a cow or two. So we had milk, butter, and eggs, and we had all the necessities of life almost. But my father did have to work out unless he rented land, sharecrop rented land. And that 1 year is all we did that.
Had your family always lived at Haskell?
Yes, I was born in Haskell in 1910, and I think they arrived in Haskell something like 1908. I'm not sure of that date. But I was born in 1910. My brother was born in 1908. He was also born in Haskell. And we only moved once during that 20 years. We moved from our original home up on 20 acres, the 14 acres I'm talking about. And the rest of the time we farmed that little acreage and maybe a little bit of rented land around us, and my dad's wages on the railroad was it. And of course he quit the railroad when we came to Shafter.
What kind of work did your father do on the railroad?
He was a section hand, just maintenance, road bed maintenance.
Did you go to school there in
Yes, I attended through the third year of high school in Haskell.
What was the school life there at Haskell?
Well, the main thing I remember, we walked. We were a mile east of town, and we had an eastward school, but long about the time I got through the fourth grade, they consolidated the schools, and we all had to go to one. And the buses weren't thought of at that time. We had to walk all that. I think it was something like 2 miles I had to walk to get to school. And like I say, I went through the third year of high school in Haskell, and I didn't graduate. I should have. The one thing I noticed that I missed. I was taking Spanish in high school, and I took 2 years of it and then dropped out. I wish I'd finished the Spanish thing, because it's pretty necessary now to have to learn a little bit of Spanish.
Why did you drop out?
Oh, just hard times. Thought I had to go to work. And naturally, now you can look back and see that you should have at least finished high school. It wasn't as important then as it is now for kids to have more education.
When you say hard times, what was happening at that time?
Well, it got down to where there was no money at all. We had to, what hay baling we did on the shares, we traded milk and butter and eggs for necessities, sugar, whatever. So it just got pretty rough there in
29 and 30. What happened to your father's job?
Well, he was one-eyed from 3 or 4 years old, but they didn't pass this rule against working on the railroad until 1930. They came up with a fact that a one-eyed person couldn't work on the railroad. They couldn't insure him sufficiently. So they laid him off.
Oh.
So we came to California soon after
that. How did your father lose his eye?
Well, his first loss, the first eye, was put out by measles when he was a child, I think 3 or 4 years old, settled in his eye, and he had no eye at all. I mean, the ball itself was gone. So they came up with this insurance thing in 1929 and 30 that they couldn't use him on the railroad on account of insurance problems. So we couldn't make it farming. So we came to California. My brother was already out here. My dad had a brother here, and my brother came out in 29, I guess it was. And they were doing all right out here. Wages were still pretty good. And here we came.
Tell me a little bit about your trip to California. How did you get the money together to make the journey?
Well, we sold our teams and harness, and the old cow, and what chickens we had. And at that time, it was pretty cheap stuff. I mean, we practically gave it away. But to get us enough money to come to California, I think we lived here in San Francisco with $18, the three of us. Excuse me.
How did you get out here?
We bought an old nice car. I think, what did we give for that thing? $75? And drove it out, and it was a headache. It took us a week to get here because it was a slow, big car. It took a lot of gasoline and oil. I do remember one thing. Gasoline was 13 cents a gallon. We got to California and had to pay 18. We thought it was terrible.
Did you camp out on the way, or did you stay in tourist
cabins? No, we stayed in tourist cabins type motels. They didn't call them motels then, but they do now. The 5 nights that we were out, we got too cold in California on the 23rd of December, and our old car gasped its last breath, and my cousin brought us home to Shafter. He lived in Colton. In other words, this brother of my father's, they came out in the early 20s and went to work for Santa Fe Railroad, and they were doing okay. So my cousin brought us on up here to his sister-in-law's house, and I met my wife at the Christmas Eve party at that time.
So you came first to Colton?
Yes, we arrived in Colton on about the 23rd, early on the 23rd. And the old Nash car just played out and just did its last deed right there. So the cousin that brought us on up here took us back, and we worked on the old car and got it going and brought it on up. And of course, we disposed of it right away. Sold it to a junk man, I think.
So you came here to Shafter, and you were living with your cousin's sister-in-law.
Well, we lived a while with my brother. He had a job with the farmer here. The house was furnished. We lived with him a few days, and with my dad's brother a few days. And at that time, there was lots of cotton left in December and January. We had to pick it by hand. And we did pick cotton for several weeks there, I think through January at least. And then, of course, it came pruning time. We didn't know anything about pruning, but we got out and tried to learn. Picking up grape pruning was big then, and we did get to where we could do a fairly good job of pruning. And of course, then the potatoes started coming off. We worked in the potatoes several years in season. Well, I finally went to work for a farmer, year-round job, and that solved all of our problems once I got to working by the year.
Mm-hmm. You know, where were you living when you were working in the potatoes and?
Well, we just rented houses, various houses around Shafter. I don't know how many, probably five or six different houses that we rented. I even tried tent living one time. I got tired of paying rent. I bought myself a tent. That was in 34, I guess. And we set it up out here at what we call Smith's Corner. It was a regular camp of trenchant labor people. And that worked all right until it came a heavy rain. And we had to get back into the renting a house idea. I didn't buy my own home until 1940. I bought a small place out on Beach in Burbank there and built a shack on it. Kept it until 46, I guess. I sold it and bought this.
Beach in Burbank, that's here in Shafter?
Yes, it's just out of Shafter, mm-hmm. About 3 miles.
What were the houses like that you rented? Were conditions pretty good for?
Well, way back in the early 30s and 40s, most of the ranches had houses for their help. And I think in 37, I moved into a rancher's house that he furnished me. And from that point on, I began trying to either work for a farmer that furnished housing or buy some of my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally did come up with that place in out on Beach in Burbank there that once we got that, strangely enough, I didn't live there very long until I went to work for the gin company, and I lived 20 years in one of the gin company houses that they furnished. I raised all my kids in that one house.
To go back, what year would it have been when you started working for the year-round farmer?
Well, I think from 32 until 36, I had steady employment. In 36, I went out with a fellow that, another Texican that had a big ranch started out north of Shafter here, and I worked for him a year. And there again, he furnished us a place to live, and by the month, I was working by the month at that time for Kurt Robertson. And he sold his lease and tractors and everything, so I moved back to Shafter. But that's the first year-round, well, it was the second year-round job that I had where they furnished a house.
Now, who did you work for in your first year?
Snide and Mettler. It was Calvin Mettler and Dan Snide, brother-in-laws, that I worked 3 years for intermittently. I mean, I worked when they had work to do.
Snide, how do you spell that?
S-C-H-N-A-I-D-T. And the Mettlers, of course, are big here in Shafter. They've always been big farmers. And Mr. Snyder was a brother-in-law. And the Snyders were old settlers from North Dakota and South Dakota, German people, actually.
When you go back to, well, those first 2 years that you came out here, that you were working in the various crops, what were conditions like for field workers at that time?
Well, I remember working for 15 cents an hour on various ranches. In fact, for the Snyder and Mettler, I started at 15 cents an hour and finally got up to 25. And the year I went out to Mr. Cursett, to Kirk, I can't think of his last name again.
Robinson.
Kurt Robinson's ranch, why I went to work by the month at $60 a month and house lights and water, everything furnished. That was in 35. In 36, I went to work for a fellow by the name of John Fox and worked for him until 40. And
go back just a bit, and what you said that when you worked for Mettler and Snyder, that you worked part time when they needed you. How part time was?
Well, usually they kept me pretty well occupied. They had cotton and potatoes and hay, and there's only a few months in the spring and the fall that I was unemployed. I was still on their ranch, living in a house rent-free and whatever. If I could go out somewhere else and pick up an odd job, well, it was perfectly all right with them. There's no problem there.
And did you find that you did usually find odd jobs during that time?
Most of the time we did fairly well on the job thing. I remember a couple of times that I worked on WPA, or SERA was the relief idea then, and WPA jobs kept us going. And
were those WPA works projects right here in Shafter?
Yes, there's signs all along on the sidewalk in front of my house here that 1941 WPA construction. And well, I think that WPA did a lot of wonderful things, like working in the forests and mountains and rivers and, you know, parks, recreation.
But most of your experience was working on projects here in Shafter?
Well, actually, I didn't do too much with WPA when about the time they'd decide that I could be on a WPA job, or some ranch job would come along, I'd take it rather than the WPA, because it seemed like it was kind of unnecessary, you know. When the farm did open, well, we took that rather than WPA.
Unnecessary. Was WPA sort of looked on as taking welfare or something?
It was a relief project. Let's see, what all did they have? Works Progress Administration was a WPA. I don't know if I can remember what all the initials stood for, but the WPA was constructing sidewalks and working for Parks and Recreation, and they did a lot of different type of things for the public, for mm-hmm. people that were unemployed. I didn't have to ride that too much. I stayed on the farm mm-hmm. jobs as much as possible.
When you were working these farm jobs in the early 30s, were your parents living with you on the ranches too?
Well, they went back in 33. They only stayed a couple of years, 3 years, I guess. They went back home to Texas in 1933 and remained there. My brother went back in 36, 37, and he's still there.
Hmm. So, why did your parents go back to Texas?
Well, they had their home there, and they didn't like to rent, and they didn't like California.
Why didn't they like California?
Well, when we came over the grapevine on Christmas Eve day of 1930, It was nice and clear in Colton, clear to the top of the mountain. We started down the grapevine, and there was that fog land in the valley. My mother formed an instant dislike for Shasta. She wanted to go back to Texas, and she knew they'd get that out of her system, so they went back in 33.
And how come your brother went back?
Well, he was just kind of the same faith. He didn't like to work for other people. He liked to work for himself. And, of course, you could do that in Texas, and you couldn't do it here. So he went back, and he owned his own home there, too. Still does. And I had a good job, so I stayed with it. And, well, I went to work for the Shafter Wasco Gin Company in 47, and I stayed with them for 20 years. So.
We skipped a bunch of years here, though, that let's go back to for a second, where we were up to the second farm job that you took.
That was in 35.
Mm-hmm. 35. And that had up to the house and
well, I think I got to John Fox. I worked for John 4 years. He was a potato farmer, cotton farmer, and hay. He kept me steadily employed until 40. And
were you married in the meantime? You said you met your wife at the New
Year's. Yes, we married in 31, in October, Halloween night to be exact, in 31. And incidentally, this will be our 50th. This Halloween will be our golden wedding anniversary.
Wow. That's a lot of years.
We're planning for some hijinks then, I think.
Yeah.
I think with the kids. But anyway, the wife and I had these various farm jobs where they furnished us housing. And of course, we tried everything in the way of obtaining a little property of our own. We finally bought that place on Beach in Burbank. It was just a bare lot, actually. And we built a shack on it and kept adding to it until we disposed of it. We bought another place on the same corner in 30... I suppose that would be about 35, 36. We bought that place and we'd had a house on it already. Then we sold out in the 40s and bought one down on the beach. Pretty nice two-bedroom home. And never did live in it. We always lived in farm-owned housing.
So you bought property anyhow. You wanted...
Oh, yeah, and we wanted something to accumulate, something to build to. And we disposed of that about 48, I guess, we disposed of that and bought this property here.
How did you happen to leave? Well, before we go on to that, what kind of work did you do mostly on the various farms? Was it?
Well, I was I could drive a tractor and irrigate and whatever was necessary. I was what you call a general farmhand. I could do just about any of it. No problem there.
When you were doing this, working for other farmers, did you have the idea that someday you'd like to own your own property and farm, or what was your hope at that point? What were you working toward?
Well, we never tried the farming thing, but 2 years in 42 and 43, we went on a farm that my cousin owned, and I went in partnership with his father, and we farmed 60 acres, and my uncle wanted to get out of it and cash out, so he got a chance to sell property and tools and everything, and wages were beginning to come up, I was paying those people $1 an hour to work for me, and I couldn't stand it. I wanted some of that $1 an hour myself, so I went back to work for wages in 43. And it was just that sort of a deal that I couldn't see a future in farming, but you know what's happened since. hindsight is 20/20.
But has the small farmer been able to compete? You know, a 60-acre farm versus the big.
Right today, 60 acres. There's no way that I can see that you could take 60 acres, even if you owned it, and make a living on it.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, it was possible, and even a lot of money in it. But nowadays, it's grown so diversified and mechanized that it costs too much to for different pieces of equipment to try to farm. I just can't see the small farmer at all anymore. He's helpless. So I didn't want to get into the small farming thing, and I sure don't want to be a big farmer. No, I've succeeded in maintaining our standard of living over all these years with working for the other fellow, and I have desired to get out on my own, but I just never did do it.
When after you worked, I guess it was then after you tried farming for yourself that you went to work for the gin company?
Yes, soon after the farming venture, I went to work for Sol Camp here in Chapter in the cotton gin. Of course, that was just for the season. It played out in March.
That would have been about 43, 44?
45, actually. The war was practically over, and I went to work for the Shafter Wasco Gin Company in 46 for a season. And then in January of 47, they let me go to work on their ranch, so I'd be steadily employed. And, of course, when the ginning season came around, then I was back in the gin again. That was my primary objective, was to work in that gin.
And what did you do in the gin?
Well, I started out as press man, yard man, whatever. I became the night ginner in 48, and they began to build new gins in 50 and 51. We built one new gin, rebuilt the old one, and acquired a third one out in the country, 7 miles west. I was trying to think of the name of the thing, Garrison City, they called it. The fellow by the name of Garrison built a gin, and they called it Garrison City. The Shafter Wasco Gin Company acquired that in 50, 51, and we rebuilt it over the years. And I left Shafter Wasco in 67 and went to work for the San Joaquin Cotton Oil, different various gins around over the country. I worked for some for the co-op in Button Willow, and then I finally got back in the co-op gin. They bought the old Garrison City gin, and I worked there a season. So up until I retired, I worked at several different gins over the valley.
Mm-hmm.
The San Joaquin Cotton Oil owns gins all over the valley, and I worked at several different plants of theirs, all the way from Bakersfield to Stratford, I guess would be the furthest north.
What city?
Stratford.
Stratford?
Yes, it's a little town just north of Wasco there.
You would live here in town in Shafter and drive back and forth to work?
I did drive for a while. I couldn't help myself. The job was way out where they had no housing at all, in a new gin that they put in, and so I drove back and forth 50 miles there. And of course I got to where I'd just stay out there for a week at a time and drive in for the weekend. But that was only a couple of seasons that I did that. And their seasons are so short now. They used to be 4 to 5 months in duration, and now they're 60 days less sometimes.
Back even then, when you started working for the cotton gin, what did you do during the time that there was no gin, no cotton to.
Well, my job with the Shafter Wasco gin was supervisor. I had to maintain the gin through the summer. Back in those days, we had cotton trailers. We had 300 cotton trailers that we had to keep tires and repaired.
I saw a whole bunch of those things as I was coming in on the.
Can you imagine 200 or 300 of those things? You have to keep tires aired up.
Yeah.
It's quite a maintenance job.
Okay, we're just about at the end of this first tape, so hold on a minute while I turn it over. Okay, so you worked at various gin companies then, and you retired in what year?
Well, I retired actually in 1976. Tried to work part-time. And my health got so bad that I had to even quit that, just go on complete retirement. When I became 65, well, it was possible to do that and pursue my hobby of the entertaining, you know. I didn't try to make a commercial venture out of it because it was there's so much competition in that, but I did like to go around to the fairs and the rodeo parades, and I got into this convalescent hospital and senior citizen thing through mutual friends. And
you're talking about your Uncle Ed's one-man band?
Right. I formed that in 76 for the bicentennial celebration, and won a trophy or two, so it gave me the fever to get into it. I won't say I got into it big, but I got into it deep. I made a lot of rodeo parades and the fair, county fair. I've done it a couple of times. And I go as far as Mojave. There's an old ghost town over there, Calico.
Mm-hmm.
I worked over there a couple of times, and they have an annual jamboree, I guess they call it. I worked over there a couple of times. We used to like to go over there pretty regular, but it's quite a ways.
Get started in this one-man band?
Well, I saw a fellow one time with one arm off, playing two fiddles and a guitar, and I said, if he can do that, I can do it all. So I acquired a drum, bass drum, and I always did play the harmonica with a wire around my neck. Grandpa Jones does that on TV yet. But anyway, I finally came up with a piece of the mic stand, flexible mic stand, and I fastened it to my guitar so I don't have to hold the harmonica in any peculiar way. It just sticks out from the guitar, and that's been my main effort in that area, was to play the guitar and harmonica at the same time. When I added the bass drum and the cymbals, that brought the kids on. They liked that, you know, because I'm doing it all. A couple of times I've come up with an electric, they call them sideman. It's a rhythm machine that I can play, and it sounds better, but the kids don't get it. Bang out of it like they do. See them, we kick that old bass around.
Where did you learn how to play the guitar and the harmonica?
Well, I picked up the harmonica, of course, when I was a kid. My dad had an organ, and I think we got our first guitar along about the time I was age 16 or 17, something like that. We learned a few chords on it. But our main instrument was the old pedal organ that my father owned. And of course, we got playing the harmonica with that. I didn't add the guitar and harmonica thing until I saw a one-man band somewhere. I don't remember where it was, but I actually saw a guy playing a harmonica and guitar and a drum. And I got the idea. And over the years, I just accumulated what I have there now. It's my ideas, mostly the rigging the harmonica to the guitar was the best idea I've come up with yet.
Did you learn to take lessons to learn to play the guitar? Or is it
No, it's entirely by ear. I guess you call it playing by ear. I can't even read music. Never took made any effort to read music. My grandson is taking music in high school now, and he laughs at me because I'm so dumb on the music thing. He's with the local band, the high school band, and going right along. One of my kids got to playing guitar pretty good, and my daughter's taking up guitar now. She's 40 years old and just now taking up guitar.
How many children did you have?
Four. That's my 11 grandkids up there.
Oh, wow. Got a few of those, huh? What, are your children around here still?
One of my daughters lives in Rialto. The rest of them are fairly close. One son lives in Bakersfield, and one in Taft, and one here in Chapter. One daughter here in Chapter.
Do they farm, or?
No, the boy here in Chapter, the son-in-law, is working for the San Joaquin, not San Joaquin, but the ranchers cutting oil mill just at the edge of Laredo, the highway over here. And my son in Taft is working for an oil company. He's into steaming those old wells and bringing that old hard oil up to the top. My oldest son is working for PG&E. He's been with them ever since he was 18 years old. He's already got his 25-year pen with those guys. He's a dispatcher in Bakersfield for the PG&E. My daughter in Rialto, his husband, has just retired from the Air Force after 22 years. And they're doing rather well right at the moment. Quite a ways away,
yeah.
A couple hundred miles away, but they're the furthest.
Lucky that your other three are so close by. That's nice.
I beg your pardon?
It's nice that your other three are so nearby.
Oh, yeah. We'd like to visit our daughter in Rialto because it is we have to go down for at least 2 days when we go and stay overnight.
Let's back up a little bit to the time that you, during the 30s period. I think you mentioned earlier that you thought that the WPA did some good projects. What did you think of Roosevelt as a president?
Well, I was for Roosevelt. We had to do something. Hoover, in our opinion, you know, just had to go. We just had the idea that we got to get Hoover out of there, so Roosevelt went in. Of course, he stayed for, 12 years or so. And during that time, I could see all kinds of improvement. It naturally wasn't altogether his doing, but I think he helped. The projects that he started, as I remember it, I said a while ago that I deliberately stayed off of WPA by taking farm jobs. But the fellows that worked for WPA got to go to the shipyards, the airplane factories, you know, during the war preparation years, and they became carpenters and welders. And all kinds of fabulous wages for those days. Mm-hmm. And I still didn't partake of it because I stayed with the steady job idea that my kids needed a home and I needed to be with them, and so I stayed with the steady job rather than running around at shipbuilding and airplane factories and whatnot. And I think course, that was after Roosevelt that the real fever began, the real construction of Meadowfield over here, for instance, started up in, I don't remember what year, but I do remember I went down and applied for work as a tractor driver, because I could drive anything of tracks or wheels. And they said, well, you'll have to get a union card. And I dug into that a little bit, and I decided I didn't want any part of the union organization thing.
Why was that?
Well, at that time it was, if you were in, you were big, and if you were out, you were not so big. And I couldn't see it that way. Everybody looks alike to me. If they can drive a piece of big equipment, well, they're just as good as the guy with the card, in my way of looking at it. But anyway, I dodged the issue and went to work for the Shatwasco company about that time, rather than follow the shipbuilding and airplane, the fever that was going around, you know, people were
speaking
taking advantage of it.
Speaking of unions, during the 30s, there were some attempts to unionize the farm workers. Were you ever involved in
the
that?
The first unionization that I remember of happening in the cotton fields was, let's see, what year would that have been? 32, I guess. Anyway, the unions wanted to organize the farm labor, and they didn't have very much of an organization. It was rather loose-knit, and I remember they struck for... we were getting 50 cents a hundred for picking, and they wanted a dollar, and they did finally get up to 75 cents a hundred for picking cotton. And I was working for the Mettlers at the time, and Snides, and they paid me 75 cents a hundred right on through from the start to finish, because I took care of all their picking. I didn't have to hire any help. The wife and I picked most of the cotton. I had one cousin that helped me, so we picked that crop practically by ourselves, and didn't partake in the strike, and the strike was finally settled at 75 cents in the first place, so I gained by not participating in the strike effort. I never was too much on strikes. I don't like the idea, the concept of a strike. If I'm working for a person, I owe my allegiance to him until it becomes patently unfair, and then I go somewhere else to go to work. I mean, that's been my theory of the whole thing. I'm not against organized labor if they can do it, but they should be organized first. State their demands and, you know, make it work or else. So I'm not so great on union organization. I see a lot of misuse of it, if you know what I mean. The thing they have accomplished is, I think, brought on the fair labor practices that we have going now. Some of them are fair and some of them are unfair, but it is going. It's working mm-hmm. to a certain extent.
What year was this in the strike thing that you were talking about? What year was it that the strike that you were just talking about?
I think that was in 32 or 33. It had to be one of those years. I'm not positive which year it was. The following year, they started early, and of course the price of cotton had gone up in the meantime, and wages had gone up along with it, so... there wasn't such a big flap over it as there was that previous time, and they saw they couldn't organize the farm labor. They've always had a problem with organizing stoop labor, the field worker type.
Why do you think that, particularly during the 30s, there were so many problems with organizing the farm laborers?
Well, just like myself, I came out here with nothing, and I had to go to work with whatever I could get, which was at that time as low as 15 cents an hour. It began to rise as prices began to go up, it began to come up, and I think wages go along with the prosperity. If the farmer's prosperous, he'll pay you a fair wage. Most of them will. I had very little problems with the people I was working for in getting what was appropriate at the time. Now you're looking back, you think, well, why in the world would a guy work for 15 cents an hour? You could go to town and buy a carload of groceries for $15. So the difference between then and now is very, very little as far as the conscient laborer is concerned. He's still in trouble if he tries to move along with the we'll take the average fruit picker, starts here in Shafter picking potatoes, and he goes north as the season progresses. They're, I suppose, picking potatoes over in Edison and Arvin now. They should be pretty quick. You come through Shafter and Wasco, potatoes a little bit later, and then you go north and you get peaches and plums and pears right on. You can still work the year around in fruit. The cost of traveling from this job to that job and maintaining a family is prohibitive. You just can't do it. So, still, it's like it was. I told the fellow the other day that I couldn't see the difference between 15 cents an hour and $15. He said, what? I said, well, I have worked for as high as $15 an hour, short job. And I can't see any difference if I have to spend my money for housing and traveling from this job to that one. Why, I'm still not making any profit. I'd be better sitting somewhere drawing less wages and maintaining my standard of living permanently someplace.
In other words, what you're saying is that the inflation has eaten up so much of the purchasing power that when you were making $15 an hour, you were right about the same as when you were making 15 cents an hour.
Exactly.
Before.
You have to go to that $15 an hour job. Your housing costs you prohibitive.
Mm-hmm.
Traveling, commuting back and forth is out. High cost of gasoline. Ways to go.
What did you ever consider, or did any of your family members ever consider following the crops, like a lot of the migrants?
I tried that in 1931, about the time the wife and I decided to get married. We went as far as Dinuba and Reedley and up in there following the crops. And at that time, it was you had to live out in deplorable living conditions. And I just couldn't see that. I wanted a permanent address, at least.
Mm-hmm. When you say you had to live out in deplorable living conditions, the people who were transient laborers that followed the crops had quite a different living condition than those that worked for the ranchers?
Yeah, when we went to the grapes up there and around Dinuba and Reedley, we lived right out in the open. Of course, it was in the summertime. We just pitched camp out on the riverbank there and picked grapes and had a heck of a time. We had a good time.
Why is that?
Well, kids, you know, about 20 years old and enjoying life, and we didn't mind it a bit. But it was primitive. I mean, we cooked on a campfire and actually just enjoyed it, as kids did. But I still couldn't see. If you start raising a family, I can't see that kind of living. You just can't do it with small kids. You have to have a house. So from that point on, from 32 on, my first son was born in 32. And from that point on, we tried to maintain a home someplace. Regardless of why, we tried to maintain a home and put the kids in school. And
when you decided to go with the crops, what That was before you had begun any of the regular year-round?
Yeah, I'd say from 31 until 33, I did try to follow the crops along a little bit, and I did succeed in getting better wages than average, but it cost you too much to move and acquire living
mm-hmm.
quarters. So right away I went to work for this Mettler and Snyde in 33, and I stayed with them about 4 years.
When you were following the crops, or when you first came to California from Texas, what was the attitude toward you by the people who lived here, the local people?
Well, of course, there was some effort at that time to turn back the tide of people that were coming from the Dust Bowl, so-called Dust Bowl. We got in just ahead of that. There was a year or two there that they tried to discourage those people from coming out here because there were so many unemployed, and you get unemployed at that kind of wages and you're in trouble, you know. So there was some effort made at that time to turn the people back at the California line. It wasn't enforced or anything, but they tried. If you remember the Grapes of Wrath, that all happened along about that time, and it was based on the true facts that actually happened. We were here and pretty firmly established, so we weren't connected with that thing at all, but we do remember the conditions that prevailed and caused a lot of that racket that was going on.
The conditions that prevailed, what are you?
Well, from 30 to, I'd say to 34, the fruit tramp, the itinerant laborer, was in trouble. I mean, he had to run like mad to get there first and get the job, or he didn't get it. There was some years there that were really rough, you know. And
tell me about those years that were really rough. What what do you remember about that time?
Well, I'm sure there were some big farms that were taking advantage of the itinerant labor, and they misused them.
How's that?
They still do. I mean, they still take the influx of foreign labor and misuse because they've got a whip hand over them. They tell them, hey, if you don't do it, I'll send you back to Mexico. You know? So that thing is still practiced, but I don't think it's anywhere near 100% of the farmers that are involved in that. Most of the farmers that I've worked for are fair-minded. They're trying to make a honest, decent profit and give their labor adequate housing and living conditions. It's not true in all cases, but I think the most big farmers now are, they've gotten away from the trying to maintain the houses out on the ranch, and they've gone to affording the labor housing in town, we'll say, and using buses or whatnot to have them commute to the different jobs. A lot of these farmers have farms scattered all over the county. One particular fellow here at Shafter he's farming land down the Old River, up around Formosa, Pond, Shafter, and Wasco. He's involved in all that, so he has to transport his labor and his machinery from one ranch to another. He's big in acres, but they're not all together, they're scattered all over. So he has a different problem. He has to commute with his machinery as well as his labor.
When do you think that it became more that the farmers didn't attempt to keep housing right on their property, but rather in town? What year about or when about did that
happen? Oh, I'd say in the 50s it started, and it, to now, there's hardly any residences out in the farming communities.
Mm-hmm.
They had to dispose of them because, insurance, for one thing. If you maintain a home for a guy to work in, you have to keep it adequate adequately insured, and it has to meet all the building codes. The fire hazard got to be a big thing here. Vandalism, it got to be a problem. So they just drifted away from furnishing housing for the laborer. It's just almost become extinct. I mean, it's just practically gone. But the reason for it is different regulations that we've imposed over the years, is insurance and maintenance and against vandalism. Mm-hmm. Vandalism got to be the worst thing here. It's the hardest thing in the world to keep a tractor out in the country. We'll say on a job, you take a hay baler and a tractor out to a man's hayfield and you leave it overnight, go back the next day and tires and batteries gone, fuel all gone. It's become a terrible problem for the farmer. I mean, it's
when
bad.
About did that start to get really bad?
Oh, I'd say in the last 10 years, from the 70s on, it's becoming progressively worse. Until it's got to where I wouldn't want to be involved in it at all.
When you think back during the 1930s, and for example, the housing that was provided. Now I know that there were farmers that had provided housing, and there were private people that had camps that you could live in. And there were the government camps. I think Shafter had a government camp mm-hmm. at that time. Of the three, which did you prefer to live in, or what were the better conditions?
I never did try to live in the Shafter labor camp, but that was formed in, Eleanor Roosevelt came out and dedicated that thing in about, I'd say 36 or 37, I'm not sure that year, but she came out to the Shafter Labor Migratory Camp and dedicated it to the working class. And at that time it was, it consisted of floor and walls and a canvas top. And they eventually took the canvas off and put roofs on them. They started a cheap housing project. I couldn't say what year that was, but they built little one and two bedroom cabins on that same property for the, I think it became the Housing Authority along about that time. What do they call that? Cheap Housing Authority? Or
HUD?
HUD, maybe that's it. But anyway, they had several of them. Wasco's got a real nice one. Shafter converted theirs to what they have now several years ago, and it's closed for the biggest part of the year. It's open during a certain season when they need migratory help while they open that thing for a few months, and they close it again. I don't know why, but it's run that way. But it's part of the itinerant labor problem, and they do use it to some extent yet. Wasco's is a more or less permanent housing, and you can rent them if you're an agricultural worker, you can rent them year round. So of course Shafter has cheap housing projects all over too. I'm not aware of how many, but I do know they have subsidized housing.
What about you said that you never tried to live in the labor camp here at Chatham during the 30s. Was there a particular reason, or
no? Just that I had better opportunities out. The different people that I went to work for, usually I went to work with the idea of being there a year or more. So we tried to work out the housing problem from their angle mm-hmm. as well as mine. And after I began to have a place of my own, that I could say, well, if you don't furnish me a decent place, I'll go get my own place and commute back and forth. But I had no problem with that after I acquired my first home. From then on, they always furnished me a place until in 67 when I moved back into this one.
That They would rather have you there on the
property? Yeah, as a maintainer, you know, of well, against vandalism, for one thing. If you lived there on their ranch, why, they'd have less problem with vandalism.
Did the houses that you lived in the for the growers have like running water and electricity and?
Yes, I don't remember of ever living in a place where the water wasn't at least available.
Mm-hmm.
I have lived in places where we had outside, you know, washrooms,
mm-hmm.
and bathhouses and laundry rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Even these government camp that we're talking about, that's their idea. They have the houses all arranged around a center community building that's where your plumbing is all available.
What did you ever hear about living in the government camps? Were people pretty satisfied with
that? I think most of the people were happy with it to an extent. I mean, they'd like to do better, but it was there and available, and so I think most of the people appreciated the fact that the government was trying to afford them some kind of housing, because like it was in the early 30s, it's quite a change from that.
What do you mean it was quite a change from the early 30s?
Well, from having to live wherever you could find, from 31 until 33, unless you did find a job with some farmer that furnished you a house, while you were out under the shade of a tree somewhere part of the time hunting for this fruit
mm-hmm.
tramp, in other words. They used to call us fruit tramps.
Yeah, I know. Did they have a lot of problem with that here at Shafter, people living on the canal banks and that kind of thing?
From 30 to 33, there was a tent city at Shafter itself, right where the lumber yard is now, and Smith Corner was a migrant labor tent city, and this place I'm talking about on Beach in Burbank, they call that the Cherokee Strip. There's a little strip of land there that Mrs. Rowe developed into lots, subdivided into lots, and sold us for very little money down, and so much a month. That's where I acquired the first lot that I owned. And she did it just out of generosity, just wanting to do something for the problem that we were having here with migratory labor. And so that started the idea of people forming groups and buying property and, you know, getting a start of some kind. And well, we had our problems out there with water. We had one fellow that gave us a problem. He wanted to put meters on all the property owners, and we were paying him, I think, something like $2.5-$3 a month for water. And he put meters on some of us. I was one of the guys that unlucky enough to acquire a meter, and my bill went to over $10. I was back in hard times, and $10 seemed like an exorbitant amount, so we fought him on it. Went to the commission and all that, the public utilities. And we had a real problem there for a while. He finally gave up and returned the property to Mrs. Rowe, and she got the thing down to reasonable rates for everybody and took the meters off.
Well, I bet you were glad to see that.
Oh, yeah.
We're just about at the end of the tape, so let me start a new one. This is a continuation of an interview with Edgar R. Crane. Okay, you were talking about Cherokee Strip, a development that a Mrs. Rowe, R-O-W-E,
right,
started. Who was Mrs. Rowe?
She was a farmer, actually. Her husband was a farmer. She was in the real estate business in a small way at that time. She got bigger. She moved into Bakersfield with her son-in-law. I don't know whether I can come up with his name or not. I'll try in a minute. But anyway, they maintained a real estate office there in Bakersfield since Mr. Rowe died. And she was just, well, as I say, she was sort of an agent for this property. And she told the farmer that owned it, said, why not lay off a strip of it there and subdivide it and sell it to these poor people that need homes. And right now, I'd say it's one of the, not fancy homes, but comfortable homes all along that whole so-called strip. I think it's about a half mile long there.
Was that mostly migrants, settlers?
Originally it was, but it was people that wanted to work the year round, mostly for farmers in the area. And so they bought a lot and built themselves a house on it, kept improving and rebuilding. So now it's a fairly well established community, something like 50 homes there, and they're well equipped with gas and lights and water.
What, getting back to this period when you first came to California, what were the kinds of people that you worked with? Were they mostly other people that were migrating to California, or were there other minorities involved? What?
There were very few people outside of Texas and Oklahoma people that were here at that in 31. And as I remember, my folks were originally from Missouri, and as soon as we got here, we had a Missouri picnic up at Mooner's Grove in Glassavia, just down Tulare there. And that settlement up there was practically all Missourians, natives of Missouri that had migrated to California. Shafter happened to be made up mostly of Texas and Oklahoma people. Very few Mexicans, and I'd say very few blacks at the time, and there's not too many here now, actually. The Mexicans are becoming more and more prevalent because they're going to stoop labor you can get anymore. People from Mexico, and of course there's all kinds of nationalities mixed in with that, but it is the basis now of your stoop labor, your onion, the people that work in the onions, and the work that you have to do by hand is mostly done now by migrant Mexican labor.
Were there ever any problems between, like, if there were Mexicans and some other groups, were there ever troubles between the two groups?
Well, back in the 34 or so there, they had a problem with the Hoover Ranch. Let's see, what was those people from? They were Puerto Ricans, and anyway, they had shipped them in here from some place else. And were using them on Mr. Hoover's ranch. And that brought on a problem between the people that were trying to organize labor here. And so there was a little flap there in the early 30s between the so-called Okies and the imported labor from other countries. And that did happen. But it didn't last very long until they absorbed all the labor and needed all the labor they could get there for years. They still do.
The Hoover Ranch, is that a big ranch here?
It's divided now. Shafter Wasco Gin Company bought some of it. Different large growers in the area bought various parcels of it. It's no longer Hoover's property. It's been sold and resold since then, but at that time it was a big operating ranch, several thousand acres, and it belonged to the Hoover Syndicate, or whatever you want to call the family, that actually did own the thing back in the 20s, late 20s and early 30s. It became subdivided, I'd say, before 40, along the early 40s, it was completely dissolved.
When you were following the crops during those couple of years before your children were born, were those mostly white laborers?
Yes, I'd say 80% of the labor force was people from Oklahoma and Texas. And, the people that ordinarily lived here were born here, a lot of them, naturally.
And did you, like, live together in camp towns, or were you sort of off by yourself?
Well, from 31 to 33, I'd say we pretty well lived in communal camps. I remember living out in the outskirts of Shafter here in a rent house. It was pretty hard to commute from it to the various jobs that I had, so I moved from that into a Smith's Corner communal camp, so I'd be available to the work. And the rain came along that I was talking about, and drove us out of the tent idea and back into renting a house, and we were in the house in that same area from a lady that had several houses for that purpose. She kept little two-room cabins, actually, for migrant labor, and kept renting out to that type of people. Along about that time, I went to work for Mr. Fox, and he had a ranch out in Lerdo, Sotko, that was too far away to commute, so we moved out there on his ranch for 4 years. And I was out on Mr. Robinson's place for about a year.
Who did you associate with when you were living in the, you know, in that years from the 30 to 40? Did you mostly have your recreation social life with other?
Well, our social life consisted mostly of weekend parties. For instance, if we wound up a guy's potato crop, he'd throw us a feed, and that would take care of a weekend, usually. Even if we did finish the first part of the week, he'd still have the party, say, on Saturday or Sunday. And we had our country dances, square dances at that time was fairly popular here, and we had one of those going every couple of weeks. And
when you talk about the social activities like the square dances, was that mostly the migrants, laborers that were involved in that kind of social activity, or was it townspeople and the laboring force?
Well, I don't know. How to say people get together on a deal like that, but you'll form friendships with the owner and his steady workers, and it'll branch out from family to family. I remember one family that we had here, the girl that I mentioned writing to and calling me about this one-man band thing. She was of a family that they had these parties pretty regular, weekend dances. They had an old fellow in the bunch that called square dances, and he knew the fiddle player and guitar player and so on. So it was just a natural place for us to gravitate to if we wanted a weekend entertainment of some kind. We'd go out to their place and have a dance. That was in between 30 and 31 and 33 or so.
Was that another migrant that had settled here from another place, or was she a Shafter?
I think he was a regular. I think he was been here most of his life. I'm not too sure of his start in life, but I think he'd been spent most of his life here, and he was working out for a rancher, had his house furnished and everything. It was a big, nice place and room. Most of us didn't have room to have a dance, but he did. An old man's name was Stevenson. And I'd say for 2 or 3 years there, he was our main opportunity for getting out and having the weekend.
What about later on in the...
Well, after I began to live out on the different ranches, why, that kind of disappeared out of our lives. We didn't follow it so much anymore. In fact, I haven't been to an old square dance in a long time. But at that time, it was our only form of recreation and relief. Along about that time, the parks started opening up. Kern County Park and Greenhorn Mountain and all that was developed by CCC. That all came about along in that time, and the kids so went through a series of working in the parks for CCC. And that was another great thing that happened along in those times. It didn't seem so great at the time, but you can see now that it was an improvement over what we had.
From what I'm gathering, there's been a lot of conversations that I've had with other people that they felt that there was hostility toward them from the local people. I don't get a sense that you...
I didn't see too much hostility. In fact, the people that I worked for were glad to have me and treated me right. And no problem.
What about the townspeople when you came into town and that kind of thing? Did you ever get any...
So far as I was concerned, I couldn't see any problem. I could see other people having problems, but it seemed to be their own making, their belligerence or something that caused it. This thing had happened at Ming Lake the last couple of times. That bothers me because I can't understand why people go out to have a good time and you know, let it turn out into be a fight, problem. I can't see that. So if that thing started back when we were young, we just forgot it. We went doing something else. Surely a better way than that of entertaining yourself.
Did your children go to school here in Chapter?
Yes, every one of my kids graduated here at Chapter.
Did they ever complain or did they ever have any feeling that they were treated differently or anything?
No, I'd say Chapter has a very excellent school system, as always has been.
Some of the places of people that I have talked to have mentioned that the children of the migrants, of the farm laborers, were treated differently than the...
I don't know how much problem they're having now with the race problems, but I don't think it's of any consequence here at Shafter at all.
Yeah, but I mean, back then when your kids were going to school, did they...
Absolutely
did they ever
mistreatment that they ever... They got an excellent education. Every one of my kids has got a good education. And my oldest daughter, Edna, she's not trying to become a teacher exactly, but she's been a teacher's aide.
Mm-hmm.
And she's seen all this problem that they have with the Mexican kids, for instance. They can't talk English and she can't talk Spanish, so they have a real problem there that we didn't have being Okies. I mean, there was no problem there. But there is a problem now with language in the schools.
Sure.
These kids coming in here that can't talk English at all, and you go trying to teach them, it is a problem. So we didn't have that back in the early 30s and 40s.
How did you get medical care back in that time? Where were you able to...
Well, you paid your own, I remember, if you could. And if you couldn't, well, you just waited until you could. I remember that was one of our major problems with the kids. We did go to Kern County Hospital with the childbirth problems, two of them. I guess three of them was born in Bakersfield. One was born here at Chapter under a local doctor. Dr. K. And of course it didn't cost like it does now for childbirth, but even then it was rough. You know, it was an added expense. And we had friends.
All four of your children born in
Kern County.
And the youngest, or the one that was born here in Chapter, was she he or she born in the hospital here or
at home? He was born at our home.
At your home.
Two-room cabin, about like this room and that one.
But you said that, that the other three were born in Kern County. Was your, did your wife have problems in delivery? Or?
Oh, no. She had with the first boy, I almost didn't get to the hospital in time. She was only just a few minutes in labor in the hospital.
So that was your decision. You felt that, that rather than having the children born at home, you would prefer to go to a hospital?
Well, that was the only answer then. The reason the boy that was born here at home, he just, it came about so quick that we just couldn't get to the hospital.
Right.
And we had to have a local doctor. He was the second one. And then from then on, well, we lived over in Sico. It's just between Laredo and Bakersfield when the third one was born. So, again, it was a hurry-up job. I mean, you had to hurry to get it there in time. At that time, the county hospital was kind of circuitous route. We had to go zigzag through Bakersfield. It wasn't easy to get there in a hurry.
Yeah. Now that pretty much covers the areas that I. Oh, there is one more thing that you mentioned briefly earlier, that the Grapes of Wrath was written right about this time, and there's been a lot of controversy about. About that book, what was your feeling about how accurate was the way that life was depicted for the migrants?
Well, as I viewed the whole story from the time they left, wherever it was in Oklahoma and Arkansas and places, they hit the same problems that I did coming out here and getting established, but somewhere in there they lost they lost contact. In other words, they took it on themselves to try to fight the organized farmer. The farmer was organized to a certain extent, and the labor was disorganized, terribly disorganized. So I said, I'm going to go out and go to work year-round for a guy. If I can find somebody that wants a year-round steady employee, I'm going to go to work for him, and I'm going to work for him. And when I decide to quit him, I'm going to find me a better job, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no problem with the employers, and I'm sure that those people did. As I remember, the boy that got into the killing part of it was the fact that he associated with some winos and, people that were out trying to have a good time at somebody else's expense, so he got in trouble. And he had to kill the guy. Well, that part was justifiable. But their whole family problem was something they could have avoided if they'd luck, maybe, or whatever it takes to, when you go from one place to another seeking employment, there's a lot of luck involved in who you contact and who you don't contact. Maybe you miss a job by a few minutes.
One of the things, though, that has been stated me a number of times is that there were a lot of people that no matter how hard they were willing to work or how much they wanted to work year-round for a farmer, there were so many people and the jobs were just few and far between.
Yeah, I'd say from 31 until 33, I've actually seen people stand at the end of a field and wait for somebody to knock themselves out working too hard. Take his job. I don't think it was quite that bad, but I've actually seen the circumstances where it was bordering on that type of problem. After, I'd say, 36, I've never seen a time that a guy couldn't work if he wanted to, if he was physically able and willing to do anything that he was capable of that could work if he wanted to.
What happened there from the time that there was seems to be an oversupply of labor to the time that between around 36 when there was plenty of work? What happened in that that changed that?
I don't think there was anything except the natural swing from nothing. Up, you have to go up if you're down on the bottom. So I think the natural thing there was for prices to go up. The wages always came up behind the prices, seemed like, but it did happen. And I think the law of supply and demand is the popular way of putting our problem. But if we could get the people that need work to the job, there wouldn't be any unemployment. And there wouldn't be any need of hiring, you know, people from some other place and shipping them in there. If you could just get the migrant to the job, you could get to the food to the hungry, there'd be no problem. But we create the problems ourselves by big farming operations right here in Chapter. We've got to where it's, you're either couple of thousand acres or you're not in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's big farming, big business, and you can't avoid it. You can't get away from it.
You used the word Okie a couple of times during the course of the interview, and I realize that you are not really from Oklahoma, that you were from Texas. But when they use the term Okie, Arky, Texican, do you think that those were intended as derogatory terms, or were they just...
Not with me. I call my wife Okie because she is from Oklahoma, just to see how the sparks fly, you know. And, of course, I came up with that word Texican. We have a wonderful Mexican lady that runs our senior citizen center here in Chapter, and she was born in Texas. And we have our domino games, and we got one Mexican fella. Oh, he gets a big kick out of playing dominoes. So I came up with a statement there one day, one Mexican, one Texican, and two Okies playing dominoes. with me, it's all in fun, and I'm sure the word has been used in a derogatory manner, but I'm sure most people don't intend it that way. I mean, there's a lot of words that's unusable in other people's estimation.
But you mentioned that when you use the word Okie with your wife, that the sparks will fly.
Way back there, the first time I ever let it slip out, you know, that I called her an Okie, well, she did. She drew a fence at it and told me off in no uncertain terms, but she learned to accept it.
Why do you think she told you off? What was it that she thought that you were saying?
I'd say the grapes of wrath was... the whole thing. We saw that way back in the picture show.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first talkies I ever saw was the Grapes of Wrath. And it hit pretty close to home. I mean, we were pretty closely associated with that type of people. So we knew where they were coming from. We understood their problems and didn't know what to tell them. And like I say, we were pretty firmly established by the time that the worst crush of that 31 and 32 migratory problem came up. And it was a problem in those days, believe me. A lot of people hurt by it.
Hurt how?
And farmers were hurt by it.
What hurt how? How were the farmers hurt?
If you're getting 9 cents a pound for your cotton, which they were getting at that time, and you have to pay 75 cents a hundred to get it picked, it cuts down on the profit of your year's labor. Mm-hmm. If you have to pay 75 cents or a dollar to get it picked, well, it's going to break. It's going to take all your profits, see? So there's no use in going that way. In my estimation, you've got to give the farmer a break, too.
These are the things that some people have mentioned to me, and maybe you had the experiences that during that time when there was such a vast influx of migrants from those four states, that the farmers were advertising in the states that jobs were available.
I think there was some misuse of their ideas of how to get people to come out. In other words, if you've got two or three people standing there wanting one man's job, well, you naturally force the issue a little bit, and it's not exactly the right way to do it. But again, you come to this law of supply and demand. If you've got plenty of labor, well, you can sort of pull back on your efforts to get them to come, you know, work for you. But I never saw any big problem there with that. And like I say, if I went to work for a fellow, and as long as he treated me right, well, I tried to treat him right. And I don't think I ever lost anything by it. I think I gained by it. And the one time that I did try farming was right at the edge of the time that wages went from 35 cents an hour to 75 and 80 cents an hour that year. And I remember I had a little crop of potatoes, and it was nearing the 4th of July, and the shed wanted to shut down. And so I had a few potatoes that wasn't picked up, and I told the people that were running the crew, I said, if you'll come out, help me tomorrow, I'll pay you a dollar an hour. Everybody on the crew, 25, 30 people. Oh, yeah, we'll be there, you know. $2 an hour, most of more than they've been getting. So I made money by it, and they made money by it. And we got the shed where a man could shut it down. We was the last grower that had anything, see. And the potatoes were pretty high that year, and so I made a profit. But that's what started me on the idea of, man, if I can make $1 an hour, well, why should I work on a farm and work my brains out here? So it
let somebody else have the worries, huh?
At that particular time, I had the chance through the government rehabilitation program to have bought that 40 acres that was available. I could have bought my uncle's machinery at a very fair price. I went to the Farm Administration loan deal and applied for that type of a loan, or 30 years, I think. My repayments on that loan would have been less than I was paying cash rent for the place. So I entertained the idea of buying that 40 acres and buying my uncle's little tractor and farm equipment. And I had some cows and chickens and stuff at the time, so I thought, well, I'll just try to arrange this government loan, and right now, looking back, I wish I had. But at the time, wages were up around $1 an hour, and there I was sitting there borrowing money to farm on. I couldn't really see it. I would have owed, $13,000 for the 40 acres. You know what 40 acres is worth now. I'd had to owe $13,000 for that. And I don't remember what my uncle wanted for all of his machinery, but it was very moderate price, old equipment, but serviceable. And I went and applied for the loan and got it approved, and then backed out. Again, I wanted some of that dollar an hour. I went to work for Central Wasco for 95 cents an hour. The first fall, they raised me to $1.05. From that year on, I never even asked them for a raise. It came automatically. When wages went up, I got my raise. And when I left the company, I was employed year-round as maintenance ginner. They call you a ginner. But actually, you're maintaining the machinery. You're keeping it up in condition and painted. There's always something to do, three cotton gins. Couple 1,000 acres of land for them.
That pretty much covers the questions that I had. Is there anything that you can think of that I haven't asked you that you would like to say while you're still on tape?
No, I think that pretty well covered up my life in California. I had no real problem working for other people all my life. And when I did, I solved it by just going somewhere else and going to work. So I don't see any reason for suspecting that the farmers or the ogres in this deal or any one group. Circumstances alter cases, and You can't avoid that.
Mm-hmm.